All right, we're in Daniel chapter 4. And you remember when I started this book, there were a lot of questions about the authenticity of the book of Daniel. A lot of questions, particularly from liberal theologians who doubt the fact that Daniel was written when it was written and that it is accurate. It was the only way it could be accurate, as far as they're concerned, is that the events that happened took place after the fact. So that much later, should I put it that way, much later, after these events happened, then some writer, using the fictitious name of Daniel, wrote this book. And so this is not authoritative, it has nothing to do with this. Well, the reason they do that is because they don't believe in prophecy, and that man... as Daniel, could predict what was going to happen in the future. Now, that is a weak argument, because the fact is that Daniel was written when it said it was written, when Daniel was alive in the late 600 B.C. and early 500 A.D. Period of time, B.C. time, I'm sorry, not A.D., but B.C., before Christ. Now, this chapter also has been questioned, whether this is authentic or not, and the objections are mainly two. First is the lack of proof that these events took place. And what's going to happen in this chapter is we're going to see that Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar is giving a sermon. Chapter 4 is a sermon by Nebuchadnezzar, and he's telling us what took place in his life. And the thing that stands out is that Nebuchadnezzar was driven from his throne, went insane, lived out in the fields and under the stars for 7 years, and then as quickly as he went insane, quickly his mind is restored to him, and he takes over his throne again. And that's almost an impossibility from a natural standpoint and from man's standpoint. So this has been questioned. But the argument is from silence. Since there's no other records recording this, they say it couldn't have happened. Well, there's a lot of things that the Bible doesn't record in human history, but nonetheless, it did take place, and that's one of the main arguments. The second argument of this book is that the miracle that took place, since most men don't believe in miracles, this could have happened. And again, it's an argument from silence, and those do not fit our. They're a weak argument. You can argue anything from silence, and this book has been argued from silence, and that it is not truth. We know that it is truth, and there are many things in the Bible. But Daniel's purpose in recording this or writing this book is not for a history of Nebuchadnezzar. He's not writing a history of Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel's purpose is not to write a history of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel's purpose is to show us the history of the Gentile nations in the world as they rule over the nation Israel. And that's what he's driving at, and all the little things that are going on in between. As I mentioned to you, what we see in this book is we see a record, a little record of what happened historically. Certainly Nebuchadnezzar ruled, and we saw that his throne was taken over by the Medes and the Persians, and then it moved down, and it was the Greeks and then the Romans, and we saw that in the statue that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about. And those actually took place in human history. But you see, we can look at human history, what's happening in the events of human history, Daniel being carried into Babylon. But if we look behind the scenes, if we look beyond that, we also see that there are spiritual purposes that are revealed in the Scriptures. So what Nebuchadnezzar is doing in this chapter, he's telling us what happened to him. That's from a human standpoint. But what he's also going to show us that God was working in his life to reveal some great truths concerning God to Nebuchadnezzar, so that he comes to a conclusion there's no other God like God. As a matter of fact, I've said that this is sort of a spiritual journey. These first four chapters are a spiritual journey from Nebuchadnezzar. It began with Daniel coming into Babylon and him refusing to eat the king's food, and yet he became his handsomeness, his whole demeanor, his intelligence was far superior than any of the others, and Daniel and his three friends. And you see all the events that are taking place in Daniel chapter 2, the image and God revealing to Nebuchadnezzar what this image meant through Daniel. And then you come into chapter 3 and Nebuchadnezzar sees this great miracle of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, and they're brought out and not even a hair on their head was singed and their clothes did not burn. The only thing that burned in that fire was the ropes that bound them. So you see all this driving. Not only is he giving us some history, but he's also giving us a spiritual journey for Nebuchadnezzar. And he's bringing Nebuchadnezzar to a point where he will understand who God is and accept him as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And as he does that, he comes into a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. Not as you and I understand it, but comes to the point where there is no other God. He believes God's message to him, and he is born again and is a part of the kingdom. Now, chapter 4 is in the form of a proclamation made by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is writing this chapter, or at least dictating it, I suppose, to Daniel, or Daniel is recording it as Nebuchadnezzar stands it. And it's made in the form of an announcement. And Nebuchadnezzar is going to tell the people of his kingdom what took place in his life. So it's looking back at what happened, informing them of this tremendous event that took place, and in which the living God of heaven made himself known as the ruler of over the kingdom of men. Nebuchadnezzar conquered all of his neighboring countries. He was doing, and in doing so, became very wealthy and a very powerful man. He was intoxicated with himself. You can't go through the book of Daniel or these first four chapters and see that Nebuchadnezzar was taken up with himself. He really thought he was something, but God was still drawing him all the way through. And you've got to watch that as you go through those first four chapters. See what God's doing in Nebuchadnezzar's life. He's pulling him to himself. Now this chapter is an account of what took place in Nebuchadnezzar's life. I have an outline for you. We went through the history of Daniel in chapter 1 as he was taken to into Babylon. In chapter 2, we see the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles are the times in which the city of Jerusalem is trodden under by Gentile powers. That's still true today. We're still in the times of the Gentiles, although there is a parenthesis in that in which the church age is made known, and you and I are part of the church age. So we're moving on in human history. We saw in chapter 2 the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, the dream of the image that he saw, the big image, the head of gold and the silver and the bronze and the iron and then the clay and iron mixed together of this image. Then we saw in chapter 3 the image of Nebuchadnezzar. He erected a large image and demanded that everyone bow down to them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow down, and so he throws them into the fiery furnace, and you know what happened. They come out of the fiery furnace. Now we're down to point C in our outline, the second dream of Nebuchadnezzar. This is another dream. If you don't understand that, and this is a proclamation by Nebuchadnezzar, you will confuse this and think we're still back in chapter 2, in Nebuchadnezzar's first dream. This is the second dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, all right? This is a climax of the journey, the spiritual journey of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel records Nebuchadnezzar's personal account of this third miracle that takes place in his life. The events that are taking place in chapter 4 are much further along in history. It's been about 40 years since Daniel was brought to Babylon. At this point in time, Daniel is probably in his late 50s or early 60s. When he came to Babylon, you remember he was a teenager, probably in his mid-teens or late teens. He was not very old. I probably would put him more in the middle not in the late teens, but probably in the early teens. And now he's an older man. Now he's in his late 50s or early 60s. And so time is moving on. And all this time, God is working with Nebuchadnezzar. 40 years. Did you know that God's never in a hurry? We're always in a hurry to see God work in our lives. We want Him to do it now. And do it now. I want this now. Lord, I'm praying and I want it done. I want it now. But God's never in a hurry. He always works on His timetable, not our timetable. And with Nebuchadnezzar, God was not in a hurry. I can't imagine Daniel seeing all the things that took place in Nebuchadnezzar's life and God drawing him to Himself and being a spiritual man, was able to understand that God was working in his life and probably was praying for Nebuchadnezzar all this time, and yet nothing's happening. 40 years have passed, and now it's coming to place. The hardest step in anyone's life is that last step. Do you know why? It's a step of faith. And faith is the hardest thing that you could possibly do. To believe what God has revealed to us. Working is easy, but faith is hard. And this is the last step, and this is the hardest step that Nebuchadnezzar is going to try. He needs to be enlightened, and that enlightenment comes to him of what the character of God and his belief in that character of God. And this all happens in the midst of his madness. So this chapter is sort of a royal sermon to his subjects, as he proclaims what happened to him and proclaims his salvation and the majesty and dominion of the Lord God Almighty. And his claims are to be revered, to be feared, be worshipped, and obeyed by all men. Now, the main thrust of this is God's sovereignty. If you want to write these verses down in this chapter, there are a number of them. I didn't put them on the board or on the overhead, so you'll have to write them down. You want to write down verses 17 and 18. Then verse 22, verses 24 through 26, verses 30 through 32, verse 34, and verse 36 through verse 37. Now I'll repeat them very quickly for you. 17 and 18, verses 17 and 18, verse 22, verse 24 to 26, verse 30 through 32, verse 34, and then verse 36 and 37. If you read those, you will see that he's really looking at God's sovereignty. And God is revealing to Nebuchadnezzar his sovereignty, and Nebuchadnezzar is revealing God's sovereignty to his subjects. Now in verses 1 to 3, we have the king's proclamation. And Nebuchadnezzar the king unto all the people, nations, and languages that dwell on the earth. The introduction is very similar to any other introduction that a king would have made at that time. As a matter of fact, if you go back to chapter 6, verses 25 to 27, you find Darius making a declaration too, and it's almost identical. Darius, in his declaration, it reads like this: Then King Darius wrote unto all the people, nations, and languages that dwell on the earth, a peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree. And so he goes on to make a decree. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar is doing. He's making known to his people, a decree to his people. And he says, I thought it good to show you the signs and wonders that the high God has wrought toward me. He wants the people to know what God was doing in his life in this time. Just turn the page here. See, I believe that Nebuchadnezzar came to respect Daniel. Daniel was an awesome man, and Nebuchadnezzar came to a greater respect and appreciation for the God of Daniel and for Daniel himself. He has put him in a high position, and so now he's going to proclaim this God of Daniel, the signs and the wonders that he's performed. The signs point out and imply a distinguishing mark. A sign is a mark, and it is a natural phenomenon that clearly has a supernatural intervention, which marks or points out God's wisdom and power. So he's looking at these signs in which God has intervened into human history, into his life in particular, and has pointed out God's wisdom and power. Wonders are those things which bring awe to someone. They're supernatural manifestations of God intervening into man. For instance, when Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego were in the fiery furnace, that was awesome. I mean, that brought awe. I mean, how could that possibly happen? And Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. He's surprised. He can't imagine what took place. And he said, I'm going to tell you the signs and wonders that he wrought in my life. How the high God has wrought toward me. He is stating that he learned through experience how great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. The two words, great and mighty, stress the magnitude of the signs and wonders. These are not just, this is not like thinking that they're there. These are things that God actually wrought. These are mighty signs, and these are great things that happened in Nebuchadnezzar's life, things that he saw with his own eyes and experienced in his own life. Nebuchadnezzar declares that God's kingdom is everlasting in contrast to his own kingdom, his temporal kingdom. Now, he knew his kingdom was going to come to an end. I imagine that Nebuchadnezzar is getting up in age, too. If he's 50 or 60, I would imagine that Nebuchadnezzar is probably in his early 70s at this particular point. I don't know when he was born, but he's getting quite old. And he's contrasting God's kingdom with his kingdom. His kingdom is only temporal. Yes, Dan? I'm sure that was part of it. But, you know, it's interesting. Nebuchadnezzar still is looking to his wise men. And that, you'll see that in the next couple of verses. When he sees this, he has this vision, then he wants to call in his wise men. So he's still interested in those men. But it is in contrast to those things. These wise men couldn't tell him the dreams. He couldn't see what was taking place in his kingdom. And here's Daniel, and Daniel's God who reveals these great truths to him. Certainly there would be a contrast there. You see, God's rule is eternal, and it's stable and it's unchanging. The kingdoms of men change from generation to generation. God's kingdom is eternally perpetual and without change or loss of stability. There's no change in God's rule. It's the same. Do you know all the instability that's taking place in the world today? Just think of the Middle East, what's happening of those kingdoms over there. I mean, there's people rising up against them. There's internal strife. There's war going on. One kingdom, I mean, there's no stability there whatsoever. No stability whatsoever. And yet God's kingdom goes on and it doesn't change. It's stable. He knows what's happening. He's ruling in the kingdoms of men and exactly what's happening. Regimes change. And there is a great instability in the world. That has been planned by God. And by the way, what took place in Japan is also planned by God. That wasn't just an earthquake. God is in control of those earthquakes. And he can do what he wants to do, and he does what he wants to do to accomplish his plans and his purposes. So, although the kingdoms of men are fleeing, they change constantly, and there's great instability in the world, the only stability that we have is in God. And we are in our country, we're in a state of instability. I watch the news sometimes and I say, are we in Wisconsin or are we in Libya? I'm not sure which we're at. I don't know which is taking place. I see what's happening in Wisconsin. And sort of not riots necessarily, but the screaming and the yelling and the marching, and then I look in Libya and I see the same things happening over there. And I told you several months ago that this is going to happen, and it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. And if it does get better, then we know that God's cycle is not quite here yet. But we're moving in that direction for His second coming. Or for the rapture and then his second coming. All right, now let's look at the second point here. Proclamation, and now the vision that Nebuchadnezzar has, the tree vision, verses 4 through 18. Nebuchadnezzar was at rest in his house. And Nebuchadnezzar has succeeded in making Babylon one of the wonders of the world. I mean, it was an amazing place. Babylon was amazing. The seventh wonder of the world was the result of Nebuchadnezzar's efforts in Babylon. Everything he had laid his hands on turned out favorably. There was nothing more that he desired to satisfy his ambition. So what was he doing? He was at rest and flourishing. That's an interesting statement, by the way. Since he put his kingdom, who is ruling his kingdom? And who else? There are four of them. The four children, or the four men, from Jewish men, were ruling his kingdom. And here Nebuchadnezzar is at rest. You know, that's very unusual at those times. Kings didn't rest. I mean, there was always a possibility of someone internally assassinating them and trying to take over the kingdom. There were those which forces from without who were trying to destroy kingdoms, rise up against the kingdom. But here's Nebuchadnezzar in the midst of great prosperity in his life, and he's at rest and he's flourishing. Isn't that interesting? The word flourishing is the word rahaman. It means to grow luxurious or to be green. It's like the green grass. I suppose Gore and Obama would be very pleased with Nebuchadnezzar since he went green. You know what I mean? I mean, he's flourishing. But he had another dream now, which made him afraid and it troubled him. I want to tell you something. Success never protects you from fear. It doesn't matter how successful you become in this world, it never will protect you from fear. There's always something that will frighten you. You look at men like Howard Hughes and other men, great men who are very wealthy, and there's great fear comes upon them. They're afraid that someone's going to take over. There's someone that's going to rob them. And they become fanatic. They really become weird. That's not unusual. Here is Nebuchadnezzar, and he's resting and he's flourishing, and yet he had fear in his life. There's something happening in his life, and he doesn't understand it. He had everything, and yet he had nothing. Because he couldn't enjoy it. His insecurities point to the emptiness of his money and his prestige in the world at that time. In verse 4, Nebuchadnezzar made a decree to bring all the wise men to Babylon before me, that they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. So he had a dream of a tree, and he doesn't understand what it is. And so if I had been Nebuchadnezzar, the first person I would have called was not the wise men. I would have called who? Daniel, right away. I mean, it would have been no mistake. But he calls the wise men, and again, it shows us that he turned right back to where he was before, to those who had proved to be inadequate in the first place. They couldn't interpret the dream, but he's calling them back to try to interpret another dream. You see, I think there's a reason. Men have to exhaust all their resources before they turn to God. They have to try everything possibly known to them except turn to God. And turning to God is the last thing. And Nebuchadnezzar is saying, listen, I call all these wise men in to interpret the dream, but they couldn't interpret it. Verse 7. When all his wise men came before the king, he told them the dream and asked them to interpret. Now, that's different in the first dream. Remember, he didn't tell them what the dream was. Now he's telling what the dream is. In the first dream, he wanted them to tell him what the dream was and then to interpret it. Now he just wants to interpret the dream. He tells them what the dream is, interpret it. But they, once again, they proved themselves ineffective. They couldn't do it. It does not appear that they even tried or to give a king an interpretation of the dream. I suspect they were afraid to do that. Human wisdom can only operate in the sphere of the finite. It cannot operate in the sphere of the spiritual things. And so they're limited. They have little understanding in this area at all. Men have the capacity to understand, do not have the capacity to understand the things of God. And see, only the spiritual are able to understand the things of God. I had written in my notes 1 Corinthians chapter 2, and you want to write that in there, because the humans cannot understand, man does not understand the things of God, because they're spiritually discerned. And here is a spiritual dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. It comes from God, and they're not able to understand it, and neither can they interpret it. But at last, Daniel came in before me, in verse 8. I don't know if Daniel was summoned or not. I suspect that he wasn't. Daniel was over the wise men, but he was over much of the kingdom, over all the kingdom for Nebuchadnezzar. And so he probably, whether it was a coincidence or in Daniel's timing, God brought him before the king, I'm not sure. But his presence must have been a great relief for the king. Here comes Daniel now. He's troubled with his dream. No one is able to interpret it. But here God brings Daniel, and Daniel enters into it. Nebuchadnezzar seems to go out of his way in this verse to remind his subjects that he is, at this point in time, still involved with his heathen gods. Notice what he says in this verse. But at last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And before him I told him the dream. So he's deliberately... Belteshazzar means God protects the king. And so he's still involved with these, he's still thinking in that realm. Now I want you to underline the word before, because it's a very important word in this verse. See, there's a little preposition before. It appears 38 times in the book of Daniel. And let me tell you why it's significant. 20 times it is used in the context of standing before a king. Daniel came before the king. All right? Here, notice what he says. Daniel came before me. 4 times it speaks out of the 20. It's used in context of standing before the king. 4 times before God. Standing before God. It is interesting now that the king comes before Daniel. And at last came in Daniel before me. So Daniel now is coming in, and the king is standing there, and Daniel reveals his dream. God certainly works in mysterious ways. You would think that what's happening, we could eliminate all this. He could have driven him out in the field. He could have, but God takes the long way and takes him through this dream so that he comes to a proper understanding of who God is. And he takes him all around. He could have revealed himself just like that. But he takes his time. He wants Nebuchadnezzar to come to him and to understand who he is and have a full understanding of him. So he takes him through the long path down this road of 40 years to bring him to a spiritual understanding. Well, we have to stop there. We'll pick it up next time. Father, we thank you for this time together, for your word. And we'd ask, Father, that you might use it for our edification, that we might grow and that we might understand who you are, and that we might understand your sovereignty, that you rule in the affairs of men. You rule over the affairs of everything in this world. And we'll thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.